It'll be for just a minute.
So just to start out, if you would say your name and where and when you were born. And
Norman Abels, born in, where I was born?
Yeah.
Oh, I was born in Vienna, Austria.
Okay.
And what else?
What were your parents doing when you were born, or what did they do during your childhood? When did you move to America?
My parents, my dad had a wholesale shoe business with his brother in Vienna.
Okay.
And then Hitler came and we had to leave.
So what year were you born?
I was born in 28.
Okay.
So we left in 39 because he was busy writing letters to people in the United States because you had to have somebody vouch for you, an affidavit. He didn't know anybody. So we just went through the phone book, picked people with the same last name or similar. You found somebody
with the same last name?
Yes. We found somebody named Abel. He couldn't find Abels, but he found Abel.
Okay.
And they said, yeah, we'll take you. We'll vouch for you. You've got to get a job when you get here. He said, okay. So in 39, we left and took a boat just as the war started.
And who's we at that point?
My mother and my brother and my dad.
So the four of you?
The four of us. So we left. We landed in Hoboken. And they picked us up and took us to Washington, D.C., where they lived.
And what year is that?
This was in 39.
Okay.
So we lived with them for about 3 or 4 months. And they found a job for my dad in a factory painting iron bars, for which he got $14 a week, I think. But that was enough. It kept us going in those days. And then what happened after that? I went to school here. I finished 1 year of middle school there in Europe, and then I started in the fifth grade here.
And where is this? Which borough?
Fifth grade was in Washington, D.C.
In D.C.?
In D.C.
Okay.
And then I went to...
So you arrived in New York and then went to D.C.?
Yes, because these people lived in D.C.
Okay.
So then I went to school there. I don't know where I started in. Then went to junior high, switched to junior high, and then finally started in high school. And because I could speak German, they gave me credit for 3 years of language.
Okay.
Just some translating.
So when you arrived, were you bilingual?
No, I was not.
Just speaking German.
Just had to pick it up. Oh, I took a year of English in school there in Europe, but that was
basically you arrived not speaking English.
I couldn't speak.
Did they have English second language sort of programs in those days, or you just had to figure it out?
Not that we knew about. Certainly didn't know.
So you just had to pick it up and figure it
out. Absolutely.
Very interesting.
I think the tea is boiling. Just a second. So where were we? I was telling you about going to high school and getting out in 3 years instead of four. And then...
In D.C.
Then I applied to Georgetown University and I was accepted.
Okay.
Except just at that time, my dad was at that point in the shirt and tie business. He was selling shirts and ties. Mostly ties. I used to have to go to the post office and mail off the ties. They decided life will be better in New York. So they moved in 45, I think. That's how I was supposed to go to college. They moved to New York. Lived in Forest Hills, where the tennis stadium is.
Okay.
And so instead of going to Georgetown, where I wanted to go, I didn't know it. I only knew one university in New York. That was New York University. People said later, why don't you go to Columbia? I said, I didn't know about Columbia. House of Constance wasn't much good. So went to NYU, where the tuition, even in those days, was only $1,250 a credit, which was outrageous in those days.
Outrageously high. $12.50.
Oh, yeah, that was
credit.
Really, it was a private school. So I had to work in the summers in the mountains as a busboy and a waiter.
Up in the Catskills or somewhere else?
In the Catskills.
Okay.
Yes.
Your first job, sort of, doing that summer work?
Yeah, basically, yes. Uh-huh. First job I got paid. And there I met my first celebrity.
Okay.
Marcel Cerdan, who was a French boxer.
Okay.
He and I played ping pong together.
How fun.
And that was the big thrill. Anyway, I made enough money, came back to college.
Were you thinking at that time you might someday be a professor? Or was this you were just going to school?
My folks wanted me to be the doctor.
A doctor.
Obviously, I had to be a doctor. Well, I didn't do that well in my science courses, although I got a B in organic, but that didn't mean anything. So when I got to be a junior senior, I decided I'd major in psychology, like everybody else.
Okay.
And this was the university, NYU Heights, which was up in the Bronx, which was all male except for a couple engineers who were women, but it was all male school.
Okay.
So I finished college there, and I decided I liked psychology, I was going to apply to graduate school.
Okay.
Psychology. And I applied to Oregon. I wanted to get away from New York. I didn't like New York. I applied to Oregon, accepted there, but the bus fare was too expensive. So instead, I got into Missouri, where I took a bus and I got there.
It's a long bus ride from New York to Missouri.
I don't know if I took a bus or a train.
I would think a train.
I'm trying to think what I did those days. I used to come back by train.
Uh-huh.
But I think...
But it was a long trip, anyways.
It was a long trip.
So how many years did you go to Missouri for
grad school? I went to Missouri about a year and a half. They only had a master's program.
In psychology?
In psychology, yes.
What kind of psychology?
It was clinical psychology.
Okay.
So a year and a half, and I worked with a guy named Daniel, who was a very nice guy.
So did you want to be a psychologist or
yes,
a psychiatrist?
No, not a psychiatrist. I wanted to be a psychologist.
Okay.
I wasn't into psychiatry. Because you had to get a med school to get a psychiatry.
Right.
So I studied with him, and I was going to do a master's thesis on sleep learning. There was a big article in the Time magazine, how you could turn on a tape recorder while you're asleep, and the next morning you don't remember anything. I didn't think that was true, the master's thesis, but I was not very good at making equipment, like galvanic skin response, to make my own equipment. So I decided it's time to leave.
And is this like right after the war, late 40s?
This was 49.
Okay.
So I applied the next year to the University of Texas. So I then went from University of Missouri to Texas.
Uh-huh.
And got my master's degree there instead.
At Texas.
At Texas. Uh-huh. And then I went on and got my PhD at Texas. Hmm. And then... what happened in 1954 was I was very busy going out with various girls and wasn't paying attention, and they sent me some letters to fill out the form to get deferral for the draft.
Not a problem.
It's better on this foundation. So in 54, I was drafted in the Army. And I took my basic training in Fort Bliss, Texas. I turned off the...
Yeah, thanks.
Did my basic training there, and then I was sent overseas.
To the Korean War?
This was during the Korean War. I was sent to France instead.
Okay.
And I worked at a hospital as an admissions clerk, and I met the director of psychology programs who came for a visit. He said, "You're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. We're going to transfer you to the Second General Hospital." Oh, I should say, when I first was drafted and finished basic treatment, they shipped me back to New York. Hmm. And I actually worked on Governor's Island, took the ferry across, and lived at home. I got extra money for living at home.
Interesting. So, how long were you in the Army?
2 years.
Okay.
And so the first year, I spent living at home, getting extra pay for that, and doing my psychology work on Fort Jay in Governor's Island.
Okay.
Which was great. And then I was sent overseas to France.
Okay.
And then to Germany. Then I came home and was discharged.
But you were, as you said, a clerk. You weren't being a psychiatrist.
I was a clerk in a hospital in France for about 3 months.
Okay.
And then I was transferred and I worked as an enlisted psychologist. But I still did what psychologists do.
Okay, so you were listening to treating
and
soldiers
and
who had...
People. Yes, soldiers and dependents, the whole thing.
Mental problems.
At the big hospital in Landstuhl, Germany, which was the big... It still exists, the big hospital. So finished that, got done with that, and then was discharged... Went back to Texas to finish my PhD because I hadn't finished it.
Oh.
Finished my PhD in 57 and came to MSU as my first job in the fall of 1957.
Now, when you were getting that PhD, were you thinking you wanted to be a university professor? Or
well, I wasn't sure. I applied to graduate. I did have some other jobs at some clinics and so on, but this one looked better than the others.
Okay.
I had not thought about being a university professor.
Okay.
In fact, they hired me at the Kelsey Center.
hired you in the counseling center?
At MSU, which was not really... They did have academic rank, but uh-huh. it was sort of pro forma.
You were really hired to be a counselor.
Counselor.
A mental counselor.
With academic rank, though. I was an assistant
right.
professor, but it was a counselor.
So it was a tenure stream job.
And then very soon I decided I better reach out and I talked to the people in psychology. I said, can I teach some extension courses, things like that? They need people to teach. So they said, oh, wonderful. You teach, and I think they paid part of my salary, a little bit of quarter, and so on. And I kept on teaching, kept going, getting very, very much involved in the psych department.
How many years were you in the MSU?
All together?
Yeah.
50.
50, okay. And so for much of that time, you did do some teaching.
Well, yes, particularly in the early years, I did a lot of teaching.
Okay, and you said it was outreach kind of teaching, meaning?
The initial teaching was, I'm trying to think whether it was extension teaching. I may have taught some courses in Grand Rapids in the evening for the university. And then they had me teaching on campus. I taught basic psychology, the 101 course. Uh-huh. I taught abnormal, introduction to clinical, some courses. And then finally, in the 60s, there was a big flap at the psych clinic where the director... The psych clinic director, which was separate, was had nothing to do with the counseling center. Psych clinic was a training.
And you were connected to counseling.
I was at that time. No, I was connected to the counseling center, but I had a joint department with psychology at that point.
The academic department.
Academic department
in social science college.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Go ahead.
You weren't doing psych clinic at that time.
No.
Right.
Psych clinic came later.
Sometimes right.
I think in the '60s.
It's okay.
The director of the clinic was asked to resign because he got into some difficulty. He did resign. And so the faculty didn't particularly want to direct the clinic because it took them away from research. They said, if you direct the clinic, you can't get enough things done, even in those days. So I was at the counseling center, and I thought that was just fine. So I switched over to psychology, to the clinic, and they took the majority of the appointment. I think I had 60% psychology and 40% counseling center. So I did some work at the counseling center, but most of my work was at the clinic, where I supervised four interns and other practical students, so on and so forth. I did that almost till I retired. But I also did research and was teaching... But at that point, I was teaching mostly graduate courses.
Okay.
And then they made me director of clinical training. And I was director of clinical training and director of the psych clinic at the same time. So I did all the administrative work that the faculty didn't want to do, and I was happy doing it.
Okay.
And I did research. I got a Fulbright to the Netherlands in 68, 69, and another one. And they invited me back in 75. So I had two breaks of 6 months each where we went to the Netherlands. And uh-huh. I was over there consulting. And then, basically, except for academic governance, I was in psychology all the time.
Okay. I'm going to come back to a whole bunch of those.
Go ahead.
Governance and the grievance procedure is a big
yes.
part of what we'll talk about.
Yeah.
But we'll get to it in a minute.
Okay.
Today or another time.
Wow.
But, so I was curious on your teaching. As you may know, at the time, labor industrial relations, now HRLR, is part of social science
yes.
also.
Mm-hmm.
And it did a lot of outreach training.
Mm-hmm.
Non-credit in the old days was the kind of thing you were doing also non-credit?
No, I was doing full credit.
It was credit classes.
Credit, yes.
So we were doing basic psych classes in Grand Rapids, you mentioned, for credit. For students who are thinking of coming to MSU, or
these were regular courses
uh-huh.
that were being taught by the psychology department
off campus,
but they were evening courses.
Okay,
so you could drive up there and teach the courses.
And we've had other ones in Birmingham or Oakland
yeah.
County and other communities.
Yeah, I never wanted to go out of town.
That's what you were doing a little.
I did teach a course in Grand Rapids too, so I did.
You said Grand Rapids, so that's why I meant.
I did teach there. Yeah,
okay.
In fact, I did teach out of town.
So these were psych department, but regular
courses.
Regular credit courses. So you had done a little of that. Another thing I was, if I'm ignorant about the difference. in the old days or now,
yeah.
What's the difference in what the counseling operation does and the psych clinic
it's
does?
The catchment areas. The counseling center was only for students.
Okay.
And the psych clinic was for the community, for everybody else. There was a time way back in the history of the psych clinic where they saw students also. But what happened was that this was Al Rabin, who died not so long ago,
was
the director of the clinic. And while he was director, there was a student and his mother, and somehow the student shot his mother.
Oh.
And there was a big flap, and the university said, no more, clinic cannot see students anymore, students will go to the counseling center.
Okay.
And the counseling center was really very big. They had about 40, 50 FTEs.
Okay.
While the clinic was just a director, four graduate students who worked half-time, and about 10 or 12 practicum students who just saw one or two patients from the community.
So in some ways, is it fair to say that the clinic, a major purpose of it was to train professionals to give them an opportunity under supervision
exactly,
to learn the trade.
And the faculty supervised.
Whereas the counseling center was providing counseling. Its main purpose was...
However, the director at the time, a guy named Don Grubin, who also died recently, who happened at the University of Chicago, where they have the stellar counseling center in the country, he thought people should be doing research. So he hired a guy who's now retired, Bill Miller, to get the research program started. And I helped him with that. So I was active in research at the counseling center, even though most of the counselors didn't want to have anything to do with that. They didn't want to do research. They didn't want to do teaching. They were happy seeing counselees 24 hours a day.
Okay. Now, counseling in this context is about social and mental issues, or does it also include course choices and that kind of counseling?
Well, there was vocational counseling, for which they even hired somebody to try to bolster that. Most of the counselors saw themselves as mental health workers.
Okay.
And they sort of had to force them to do vocational counseling. But they had what was called the summer clinics.
Uh-huh.
And the summer clinics were the orientation things that students go through here, except in those days they were about 3 or 4 days. So all the counseling center people were expected to staff those orientation clinics and advise students what courses to take and so on, although they did it very reluctantly. They thought they were psychologists, mental health workers and so on. They didn't like to do that, but they did it because they had to. So they had some vocational counseling. In fact, many students came in for vocational counseling, and as soon as the counselors saw them, they often found they had problems, and they converted them into mental health counselors, some mild, some more severe.
By vocational, you mean helping them figure out what courses to take
for
different career choices?
They had academic advisors. This was more general, testing, vocational tests to show what you'd be good at, what you might want to do as an occupation. So it was a step above, in the people's eyes, above advising, which was simply, take this course, take that course. And the advisor's still here. The counseling center is still here. And counseling center is mostly mental health.
Okay. So not to belabor too much about that, but in terms of the mental health aspects of the counseling center, any idea of how many numbers or what percent of students got services in
those years they were 30, 40% of the students came to the counseling center. It's just a large number.
And what were your years of being connected to them again?
I was connected to the counseling center really when I first came. So it was 57, 67. Well, I was with the counseling center full-time and then part-time till about 75 or so.
Okay. I'll get off of it because it's going way back. But you did mention that while doing counseling center work, you did some research. What would research mean at counseling?
We were doing research on what was called counseling process, which was can you predict for what goes on in a counseling session how effective the counseling is going to be, how soon it's going to be done, how many sessions it takes. And it was studying the verbatim transcripts of the counseling, which in those days you could just simply tape record. And you didn't have to go through the research protocols and things like that. Soon afterwards, that sort of died. But initially, there was no restrictions. You can't, as long as the client signed a letter saying, I permit you to mm-hmm. listen to these counseling statements, do research uh-huh. for the benefit of students, that was all. That was good.
You didn't do longitudinal things to find out what happened to the kids long term, I assume.
There was a little bit of that, but it was mostly process stuff mm-hmm. at the time.
Okay.
So that was that. But there was not a great deal of enthusiasm, in my opinion, about counselors doing that. Most of them were service, oriented towards service. They went out into research, which is why eventually the counseling center lost academic rank.
Okay.
One day the provost came down and said, no more, you guys are a service organization, and we don't have enough money to pay to promote you and give you tenure. You have job security, and then they also started hiring social workers, so that changed.
Okay. Anything else I should ask you about counseling service?
No.
We can move on.
We'll move on.
Okay. So, let's, before we do the clinical center, in terms of the psych department, mm-hmm. you did some teaching that you mentioned,
yeah.
some of the large general mm-hmm. intro courses, but then
yeah.
you said you did some grad teaching later.
I did the grad teaching when I became director of the clinic. I didn't have to teach as many undergraduate courses. And I could teach graduate courses, like it was a course called supervision. I got credit for supervising students, as did the faculty, but I got more credit because I supervised more students. So those were small courses. And I did teach special courses in assessment, like teaching them the testing that they had to do, like intelligence testing, personality testing.
Okay.
So I taught them how to give those tests. And then later, I developed what was called the neuropsychology program, which is the brain behavior, which had even more complicated testing.
Hmm.
It took a long time. And there, we actually had attorneys from the community referring people to us for brain behavior testing, neuropsych testing. So we also had contracts with Grand Rapids, with the Veterans Home, and a contract with the geropsych unit at Ingham.
Mm-hmm.
So they had hospital experience as well as veterans experience and so on, and they learned a lot, so they got much better jobs.
Now, these master's and PhD students? Or?
We started them at the master's level. Most of these were doctoral level students.
Okay.
But they learned the test when they were getting their master's
degree. Okay. And when you said small classes, we're talking 4 to 12 in the class?
At most.
At most.
Mm-hmm.
In comparison, some of the intro psych that you were doing in the earlier days, what size
still
classes?
Still small. Actually,
okay.
even the intro course, I think, was only about a couple hundred.
Okay.
And the abnormal was about 70, 80.
Okay.
Introduction clinical may have been 100. It was all less than 200. No six on credit. And I think I only taught intro about once or twice. I think I taught the outer section. So it was small. So I was never exposed, as were some of my colleagues, to teaching 500 students.
Uh-huh.
I never did that. So I'm used to medium small level.
Meaning 100, 250.
That's right. Nothing big.
Nothing real big. You mentioned that some of your research connected to that teaching. What was the connection there? And then let's switch over to the clinical center.
The teaching at the graduate level involved me teaching them how to administer the tests and how to evaluate the tests and how to write reports. So the teaching was teaching them how to do this.
Okay. What kind of testing is this?
This will be intelligence testing and neuropsych testing, which is a long battery, reaction time, memory, speed, dexterity, and so on, things that predict whether there's something wrong in brain behavior relationships.
These are for people that had some kind of troubles.
Yes. Some of the people who'd had they might have fallen in a motor vehicle accident or something like this, the more severe kind of thing, they often refer them to us. And they were still students. The question was, could they continue in school?
Okay. But earlier you mentioned that in the clinical center, mm-hmm. it later becomes exclusively not students. It becomes a...
Oh, yeah. They had cut out the students way back, way before I got on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got there, they were seeing only people from the community. eventually, very late in the game, we did see some students who required intensive testings, and they were further. The counseling center couldn't handle that. They didn't handle those tests, and they were further to the clinic, but not that many. We were still mostly community level people.
And the providers of this service, whatever, that you're helping supervise, are all doctoral students?
Yeah, all doctoral students.
Okay. Mm-hmm. There isn't a staff like there had been at the counseling center
no staff.
Of?
We were student one.
Okay. Okay. So the research you did in relationship to that work in the clinical center then was about testing?
Often related to testing, yes.
Often
it was
related.
No longer oriented towards therapy, more oriented towards testing.
The kind of testing you just described?
Yes.
And so were these sabbaticals also on that kind of a field?
The sabbatical, I had applied for four months before, and I was asked to come to Utrecht, the Netherlands, in an outfit which was geared more towards helping students vocationally, I think. Mm. But I never saw any students there. I was sort of on the staff, and I gave them advice and so on. And it was fairly easygoing. They didn't push me very hard. And I became friends with the people who had selected me. And it was generally a good experience. I gave some lectures, and I talked, and I wrote a couple articles for them and so on.
Was that in English or German?
It was in Dutch.
In Dutch. Mm-hmm. So you learned Dutch?
I learned Dutch, but not fluently. I had to have it translated.
But enough to give lectures? Or were you speaking in English?
No, the lectures were in English. They supposedly, the listeners knew enough English.
Uh-huh.
Although I was never convinced they did. And they their teaching was four sessions here and three sessions there. It was never a whole semester. They were little bits.
Like the med school.
Yeah. You taught little segments. So
yeah.
And they were fine.
I was just curious if you did in that country because you were using your German or something, but no.
The Dutch hated the Germans.
Uh-huh.
It was not wise to speak German.
Uh-huh.
German in the Netherlands. So I blundered along with a little bit of Dutch I picked up. I could read the paper pretty well. And I probably still can a little bit. But I could never hold a conversation beyond shopping.
Did you just pick that up to do these sabbaticals, the Dutch? Okay.
Nothing before.
I was curious, did you ever end up using German for other things in your career or personal life?
Actually not, except when we traveled. I mean, I could shop, but I didn't use it beyond that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was gone.
Interesting.
Yep.
So we want to talk a little bit about the clinical center before we talk about governance?
Sure.
So for what years, what was your position there?
It wasn't called the clinical center. Clinical center is something else.
Okay.
Clinical center is the medical facility on campus. This was called the psychological clinic.
I'm sorry, that's what
I meant. That's right. And I got there, I don't know if I got there, 65, 66, and I stayed on till almost I retired. Or no, until the late 80s when I stepped down.
Organizationally, was it connected to the psych department or otherwise?
It was an agency of the psych department.
Okay.
And more specifically, of the clinical psychology program.
So okay.
It was the training arm of the program, of the clinical psychology program. And the clinical psychology was one of the areas within psychology. There was clinical, industrial, cognitive, whatever, and so on.
Since the late 70s, when I came here, the psych department was by far the largest in social sciences and one of the biggest on campus.
Still is.
Was that always the case
always
in your
case.
Years?
Psychology was the most popular major on campus ever since I can remember. And
okay.
I think it's still one of the most popular majors.
Okay. So the proper name is the
Psychological Clinic, yes.
Psychological Clinic. So the years you were connected with it was much of your career.
Most of my career. Mm-hmm.
And some of those years you're the leader.
Yes.
What were your responsibilities there? And did you report to the chair of the department?
Technically, but I mostly reported to the faculty.
The faculty in
the
that?
Faculty in the faculty, to the clinical faculty.
Okay.
So I was responsible for writing an annual report, letting them know, and then for a while I was also the director of the program. the clinical training program had to have a director.
The academic program.
Yes, the academic program. And for a while, I did both.
Oh.
The director of the clinic and director of the training program.
Sounds busy.
And that worked very well because I never had any arguments. When I stepped down eventually from being the director of the training program, they appointed somebody else to do that, and immediately there were some differences of opinion, as you well liked it, between the training director and the clinic director because money was involved. They said, well, you don't really need four people half-time to do this thing. You can have three people do half-time. You don't need to do all this. Don't need to do all that. Let's cut back. Let's move the money sideways, something.
Uh-huh.
So conflicts began to arise. Then there were policy conflicts.
Now, is that training program exclusively a doctorate program?
Yes.
Or, okay, so not master's and undergrad either.
No undergrad and no master's. We gave a master's degree, but just sort of in stopping. We admitted nobody to the master's program. We admitted everybody to potentially be in the doctoral program. So
okay.
If we thought somebody could only do a master's degree, we did not admit them to begin with.
So how large was that program in the years you were involved?
There was a time when we admitted 20 to 25 students a year, which was huge. And we had a government training grant to pay for that. NIH paid for it. Well, now I think they're admitting 4 students a year. But the difference is, in the early days, if a student didn't have a training grant from the government, they had to pay their own way. We didn't have enough money to pay 25 students. Now, with the 4 students, there's enough money to pay the whole way for 4 years. So they're very, very selected. Of course, now they select people primarily for research.
Okay.
And they become attached to a faculty member in the program who's supposed to get grants also. And the student worked with that person.
Now, when it was 4 students late years or 25 earlier, how many faculty weren't connected to this?
The faculty did not change a great deal. The clinical faculty was always 10 to 12 people.
Okay.
I think we may be down to 9 now, 8.
Okay.
But it was small. And the rest of the programs had the other 40 FTEs. So we were about 1/5 of the program, but we had a lot of influence.
All tenure stream faculty?
Yeah, because we admitted more students than anybody else, yes. But that stopped. We now admit about as many as the other areas admit.
Okay.
But the graduate training is very expensive, so that's the chair always looking over your shoulder about where can we save money.
Now, during your years that you were connected with that program, did it change in terms of the expectations for faculty of the balance in terms of research, teaching, service?
Totally.
In what ways?
Service was never valued very much anyway. So the service, the site clinic was not designed as a service installation. It was designed as a training facility, but research was the main emphasis. And so all the students said, oh, yes, I want to be a doctor. If you admit me, I'm going to be a researcher and a professor. They still say that. But in fact, if a student doesn't have 2 or 3 or 4 publications now as an undergraduate, they probably won't even be considered
to be
admitted to the doctoral program. So even the people who admit to the doctoral program expect to have publications. Usually with not first authored, but usually with a mentor. So.
And these are the kind of publications that have 6 or 8 authors or something
often,
like that?
Yeah.
And you list
and
the names of the undergrad students that assisted in research.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And once in a while, you have a very bright undergraduate student who might be the second author, sometimes even first author. But if they hadn't published, hadn't shown a lot...
You wouldn't even get admitted anymore.
Wouldn't even get considered for an interview.
But in the earlier days, that wasn't the case.
In the early days, it was much relatively easy. Although everybody said, oh, yes, I'm going to be a researcher. But it wasn't true. They all went into independent practice.
Okay. Did it also change in terms of the expectation of how much focus on getting dollars by faculty?
Oh, yes. That has changed fairly recently within the last 10, 12, 15 years.
Okay.
Not in the beginning. But that now the expectations of every faculty member has enough grants to support their own students, so the department does not have to pay for the graduate student. The hope is that the faculty member, in order to get a student to work with them, would have to have funding of their own, independent funding.
Now, this means master's and PhD students are only doctoral?
No, it would be both be masses both. Of music.
Okay. And that's pretty much across all the psych department
fields?
Oh,
yes, absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm. That's the expectation.
Okay.
You have to have grants to keep going. In fact, in order to get promoted, you have to have significant grant funds. Otherwise, you don't even get promoted.
Mm-hmm. And that's something you've really noticed change during your years?
Major change. Mm-hmm. Major shift.
Okay. Anything else you want me to ask you about your research or classes or the site?
No, I think you got it pretty well.
So how and why did you get involved in academic governance?
Good question. Well, I always felt like I should be active, and I like to do a variety of things. And I think my first committee, and the one I was on the most, was the University Committee of Faculty Affairs. Because I realized they had to do with the budget. And I was always interested in where the money was coming from.
Okay.
And while it had no direct input on the department, it had some significant implications for the university, because that's the one committee where the provost sat in,
mm-hmm.
and where the budget officer sat in, and where the assistant provost sat in. So it was seen as an important committee.
What's the title then, as it is now, University Committee on Faculty Affairs?
Had that changed.
Okay.
And the other thing is, I took advantage of the fact that relatively few faculty wanted to be on academic governance.
Uh-huh.
It was seen as a bother. Don't bother me with any, it's just one of those committees.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they realized how much influence that faculty affairs committee had. And even more importantly, that the faculty affairs committee always appointed or elected somebody to be a liaison to the Board of Trustees. I thought that was important. So I got involved in being liaison to the Board of Trustees through faculty affairs, and I tried to hold on to those, and it worked very well. So I got to know the trustees very well as faculty members can.
Right.
And I thought it was a good experience.
Do you remember approximately the years you were on UCFA or the liaison? Or are we talking about the 80s or the 90s? Or
maybe earlier than that.
In the 70s.
Okay. 70s through the 90s, yes.
Okay.
Someplace those dates are available officially.
Mm-hmm.
But for about 20 years, at least 20 years.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And there may be an occasional year where I wasn't on, but I was usually on academic governance.
Now, UCFA, was it the same then that there was one representative per college?
Yeah, there was some kind of per capita assignment. How many?
So you were there for College of Social Science?
Always Social Science, yes.
Right, not the department.
That's right. I was always the social science director. And mm-hmm. I didn't have much capital. Well, once I had won a couple of times, I didn't have to worry. I got I had name visibility. I usually got elected. I don't think I ever got turned out.
Okay. Well, like I said, I thought this time we could overview some things, and then if it gets you thinking about some things, I'll come back with some specific questions. But just in terms of UCFA, is there anything that sticks out in your mind as one of the more interesting, important, or any particular events, rather than just thinking about
general things?
That you were representing faculty relationship to university policies and procedures.
The big issue was, and that was fairly recently, within the last 15 years, selection of Luann Simon as president. Because that was a very contentious issue. Because a lot of people are arguing, let's have a national search. I think there was a national search. But when push came to shove, Joel Ferguson was pretty influential as a trustee, and he pushed for Luana. And faculty affairs, the liaison of the Board of Trustees, at least were bystanders. I don't think we were in the back room.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a lot of inside knowledge.
Would make reports to you.
Yeah. And the other thing was, the other significant annual event was faculty raises.
Okay.
Faculty affairs always recommended raises larger than the university would give. I mean, as a strategy.
Right.
And they usually cut us down But some years you got nothing, and some years you got 2, 3, 4, and even 1 year we got 5%. So we were influential in debating and arguing with the budget people how much of a raise the faculty should get. And while the faculty wasn't much aware of that, there was always this article in the June school paper about how much we had recommended and how much the university gave. And the university always told us, well, we can't do this, we can't do that, and so on. We kept pushing back and forth. And we usually got a little bit out of it. It wasn't a great deal, more than we thought we could get. But it was an interesting, interactive thing, which basically took all year.
What's interesting, you mentioned the choice of the selection of Simon. That one strikes you more than the selection of any of the other precedents, because there would have been several others during the times you're talking about.
That's
the
right.
Queen.
It goes back to Wharton and so on, this kind of thing. However, the difference... Is this going to be public, by the way?
If you want me to put on pause because you want to say something, let's banter.
Yeah, it actually turned out well. Okay, back.
But I just was curious because I think there was some debate with President Simon in terms of that her whole career had been here. And you have that in departments where you have discussions about should we hire one of our own PhD students, how long do they have to be away before we might hire them.
Exactly. But there's always a discrepancy between what the faculty wants and what the trustees want.
Yeah.
Trustees' viewpoint is more pragmatic.
Yeah.
And they want to know what works and what's easy, what's complicated, and so on.
Yeah.
It was...
But there were some... The reason I asked about... You may recall that in the early 80s, Michigan had quite a recession.
Because
of the auto industry problems, and it really affected the university, and so Dr. Mackey ended up coming in.
And he was seen as the hatchet man.
And he was seen as this hatchet man hired from Texas to come in and cut things apart.
And he did.
And some of the things he proposed didn't get cut, like nursing, but some did get cut.
I remember the fuss there was about the nurses coming to the union, protesting en masse, and hundreds of people saw it.
Right.
He had to back off.
Right.
And now nursing is college.
But at the time, it was on, I believe, on the list of things we might cut.
Oh, absolutely.
And there were some other smaller programs that were cut. But anyways, I don't recall when he was hired, because I wasn't doing governance, if there was a debate about bringing him in, or it wasn't until after he arrived that people started complaining about Hatchett.
There was always a debate about any precedent. And what we had heard about him was not positive. And he'd been at several places. He very wisely, by the way, when he stepped down, declined the job from Hawaii, which was wise for him to do that, because he would not have gotten the job anyway. They offered him the job, and then he said, no, I don't think I want it. It's because the Hawaiian politics were so intense, they didn't want to hire somebody from the mainland who was not Hawaiian. That was a separate issue.
I don't recall any big negatives or issues around Dr. DiBiase's years, but I do recall that there was some controversy about his provost during that time, because he was quite an innovative fellow. I wondered if you had any...
So who was the provost?
David Scott.
David Scott...
Because if you were in governance at the time, you would have had...
The big fuss was the 400 to 399 vote. And he said, even if you vote the other way, I'm going to do it. And what was it he did? I'm trying to recall. There was a huge fuss about that. Do you remember what...
I believe it was on the changes of going from...
Oh, the quarter system.
Quarter system to semester.
Yes. And
we voted twice.
And Miller, who was the grievance officer, was active in researching all this kind of thing.
At a point when he wasn't grievance officer, he was the faculty representative coordinating...
Exactly. And there was a huge fuss about
this change.
Yes.
And my recollection is we voted twice because we didn't vote right the first time.
Maybe, yes. And did the second time to go Scott's way?
Yeah. I do believe that's how that worked.
Well, there's an even earlier issue. The six-month presidency of Walter Adams.
Okay. You recall anything about that?
I'm trying to recall. He was backed by the faculty. The faculty thought he was it.
Uh-huh.
But I think he was an interim president.
Right.
And
I think one academic year.
Not even that. I think it was academic year or six months.
Yeah.
And I remember one time the counseling center had invariably been cut short on raises.
Okay.
And that year also, we were not going to get any significant raises. And the director we had at the counseling center at that time was a very sweet guy, but basically ineffectual.
Hmm.
He's gone, long gone. And so I went over to the president's office. And I saw Walt Adams smoking his cigar. And I said, look, we're being screwed and so on. And he actually did something for us.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, the reaction I got was, this was for the counseling center, I said, how could you do that? You're not supposed to do that. You didn't go through channels. You didn't go through the vice president.
Right.
Kind of thing. But anyway, that was just sort of...
No, I interviewed Walter years ago.
Walter was great.
He was a great guy.
I used to have lunch with Walter, the economist.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I remember the day he came and said he has the disease that killed him. And everybody was shocked. And he kept meeting us for a little while longer, and then, of course, he died.
Mm-hmm. But
yeah, that was exciting.
Yeah, it was an interesting time. And, of course, part of his short-term presidency had a lot of student conflict because of the war in Vietnam.
Actually, he wore this whole Jack of Vietnam jacket and so on. He marched and so on. A lot of people thought he was way out.
Well, because he had been such a decorated and so involved in the U.S. military
World
War II.
Yes.
And he proudly always let people know that he was been in Normandy, but yet he was supportive of the kids' right to complain about the Vietnam
War.
He was
very opinionated, and he was considered a fantastic teacher.
Uh-huh.
Even now, people say, I had a course that was the best course I ever had.
Uh-huh.
So he was a terrific teacher.
But anyways, I think that I was just kind of... during those times was much of the late 70s and into the early 80s, the provost was... I'm trying to think who it was that you would have dealt with.
Lee Winder?
Yes.
Yes, I knew Lee Winder well. Yes. Uh-huh. I thought Lee Winder was a very fair guy. He was not liked by the department, by the faculty too much. They thought he was too much of a...
Administrator?
Administrator. in fact, I wrote Lee's obituary for the American Psychologist. But I always thought...
Had that been his field?
He was a director of the clinic before I was.
I didn't realize that.
In fact, what happened was Lee Winder was, when I first came into the department, Lee Winder was on the faculty. He was, I think, was an assistant professor, and he was director of the clinic, and he left to go back to USC for 1 year. At which point, the department said, how would you like to be chair of the department?
Hmm.
And he came back, became chair. So it was a quick promotion to chair. And he was, then he became dean, and then associate provost, and then provost. And he was well thought of as chair for a while. I think he succeeded a guy named Lou McQuitty, who preceded him. But later, Lee Winder was seen as too much of... on the pro-administration side. He was not seen.
Well, was he provost during the Mankey years? I mean, that would have been tough if he was.
I'm trying to think if he was provost during the Mankey years or not.
That's the kind of thing. I didn't bring that stuff
up. Yeah, I'd have to get a chart out.
And we could do that another time.
And you mentioned DiBiagio. While DiBiagio was seen as a very sweet and lovable guy, the faculty thought, what is this, a dentist being president?
Right.
They didn't think much of that either.
Right. There was criticism that he didn't have...
academic credentials.
That he and Lou Anna didn't have that background. But,
yes, but Lou Anna was worse about Lou Anna, yes.
But, and part of the reason I mentioned David Scott is there were some people who did not like his numerous alphabet committees that he had looking at everything, Q and Courage, and I can't even remember all the names.
Oh, yes, I remember all that.
But if you were in governance at that time, you would have all had to time. Relate to some
all
of that.
All the time, yes. We were always listening to reports of some.
Because I assume David Scott would talk to you about that at some of these meetings.
Absolutely. I would have to come back on that, yes.
So probably having Luann as provost after that was refreshing, but it wasn't more calmer or something.
Much calmer. She did calm things down.
Uh-huh.
And you have to say Luann has done a good job. And she gets along with the trustees, and she, while she has some people who are favorites, everybody does, I think most people think she's doing a good job.
But it seemed like her years as the provost were easier. I mean, there are other reasons why too. Relate to the economy and how MSU is doing, but that some of the others didn't have. Yep. But one thing that you haven't mentioned, and maybe it just didn't come up during some of your years in governance, there were attempts to unionize the faculty.
Oh, several attempts. My reading of that always was that the faculty would never agree to this. No matter what you wanted to do, this was not something they would go for. It was just by definition. In fact, the students finally unionized.
The grad students.
Grad students. But the faculty never went for that. Because I think the faculty felt, we're not Western, we're not Central, we're not Eastern. We're like the University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. The University of Michigan is not going to have a union, faculty union. Neither is MSU. And Wayne State, we didn't pay attention to what Wayne State was doing. Yeah, that's true. But it was not something that was ever very actively discussed, even though there were a lot of advocates on the faculty.
But it didn't come up in the governance when you were doing governance stuff?
Not really very seriously. Because mostly the people in the humanities and social science, general social science thing, they were arguing for this, but there was just not any support for it.
Okay. So it wasn't something you talked about in academic governance?
Not really. I think actually we're not supposed to talk about it because the union was outside the realm of that.
Okay.
Thing, so. But nobody worried about that.
Okay. So what was your knowledge or experience with the grievance procedure of the university, the faculty grievance procedure?
Well, the grievance officer always came and gave us reports and sat in with us. And I think we had some pretty good grievance. Well, the most interesting grievance was Lash LaRue.
Mm-hmm.
And he was always outspoken, always for the students. Sometimes his opinions were more to the far left than center.
Uh-huh.
But he's the only one who wrote a column for the State News with a helmet on and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And the only one with a Rolls Royce driving around and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And what a good friend of Walter Adams.
Right.
And he sometimes joined us for lunch. I thought he was a great guy, but many of the faculty thought he was sort of way out.
Uh-huh.
In fact, interestingly enough, this woman who took your place was also very critical of a lot of things that are going on at the university in her day.
Well, she was the AUP chapter chair during the time of the debate that had occurred before her that related to Peter McPherson as president and opening the med school over in Grand Rapids.
Oh, yes, and she was terribly opposed to that.
And she inherited the AUP chapter at the time when people had led to another one of the few times the faculty Senate ever met was to complain about the Grand Rapids.
I remember that because I was involved in some of that. We talked about that a separate time. But I think the administration had a tendency, at least at times, to appoint FGOs who had been very critical of the university.
Hmm.
Lash LaRue certainly met that criteria.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this woman,
Sheila Tehan?
Sheila also, but not as much. The other ones, no, Bruce Miller, I don't think that was an issue. Who else was?
Mike Rubner.
Mike was a nice guy, a member of my synagogue, so on. I always thought he was a good guy. I liked him.
You wanting to know the other ones?
Yeah, who else?
Michael Harrison was the first.
Yeah.
But he only did a year.
I didn't know him very well.
Uh-huh.
I see him every once in a while.
Gordon Thomas did a short
Gordon
stint.
Gordon Thomas was the ultimate pipe smoker. Yeah.
Rubner's was the longest.
Yes.
He did 15 years.
Yeah, Rubner was solid.
I was probably the second longest at 8 years.
Uh-huh.
Bruce Miller had two stints. He was the official for a couple of years, but then he came in acting. And LaRue had two stints. He had a couple of years as the grievance official,
yes.
And then he came in acting. During part of the 80s, there was a female professor who was the grievance official for 5 years.
She was awful.
And
I don't know why she got appointed.
It was a challenge.
Did Cecil Bakke appoint her?
I would think that's correct. And actually, at the time, Mike Rubner wanted the job. So there was a bit of a...
She was not. She was at the vet school. And she was... I didn't have much personal contact with her. But the general sense was that she was not... a good choice.
Well, I've interviewed all the grievance officials except for...
Is she still around?
She lives in Florida, but we did a telephone interview.
Oh, okay.
Same
I'm just giving you my opinions off the top of my head.
And
I hope you won't attribute all these stuff to me personally.
She wouldn't mind. I mean, I think she knew that it didn't go well.
Yeah.
I mean, there were... But I don't think she had any track record... being an activist of any sort.
No. And I don't think that was necessary. So in fact, I think the only two were Tehan and Lash LaRue. I don't think the other ones were really viewed as activists by anybody.
Well, I think I was, but that's
maybe
interesting
you were,
that you didn't realize that.
Or at least it didn't surface much.
No, because it
came on pretty late, so I had not paid much attention to that.
Exactly. But I had been involved in the faculty unionization attempts.
Ah, I see. Uh-huh.
And
AUP, in my opinion, has never had any real impact on the university either.
And my years of involvement there were pretty calm and an extremely small chapter.
Yeah.
And very modest.
And never did anything.
Nothing exciting like... But Sheila inherited this faculty voice crisis, which led to that Senate meeting.
Yeah.
That was one of the only other times. We've only had a couple Senate meetings.
Oh, very seldom, yes. And 499 vote was one, and the med schools.
The spring of 2004, which was when the transition from Rubner to me, was the faculty voice, and there were two complaints. One we talked about was the issue about the med... The human med doctors
big debate.
Going to Grand Rapids, and there was a lot of anger, and the faculty voice part of it, I think, was you didn't ask us. But there was another complaint, and I'd have to think about what it was. I didn't... There was a second issue that led to that. And I think Dr. Tehan was the chair of the AUP chapter at the time.
Yes, yes.
So that led to some of that. But Bruce certainly wasn't, because Bruce had been a department chair.
Bruce was really seen, I think, as a pro-administration guy. And I like Bruce. He's a nice guy, personally.
We got along very well.
Venetian godless. I mean, he's just fantastic. And his latest wife is Venetian, so mm-hmm. Italian. So I always thought he was a good guy. He was a friend of Peter Asquith from philosophy.
Bruce and I got to be buddies because... During most of Rubner's time as the grievance official, while there's a pool of people who are willing to serve as faculty or administrator counsel for grievance mm-hmm. hearings, Bruce and I tended to do it very often. And so Bruce was often the person who was representing the dean, director, or chair, and I was representing the professor.
Yes, he was voted.
And so we did that quite a few times.
He was good.
And that's how we got to know each other. And I probably is part of the reason I ended up doing the FGO job.
There was also this big case was it Winder versus Koo, K-O-O, from economics? Mm-hmm. There was a big fuss about that. I forgot exactly what it was.
There have been a few interesting ones over the years.
Yes.
But that pretty much is not something I can talk about the details.
Sure, no, I said.
But you, anyways, if you were doing UCFA, at least in the later years, I don't know how far back this tradition went that the grievance official regularly met with UCFA.
I think they did. Yeah, I think
they,
so.
They at least made reports because it's,
they made
it's
reports.
Always
I know
been
they
in
made
the,
annual reports. I don't know how often.
But it may be that it started under Michael, that the grievance official actually goes to every weekly
maybe
meeting.
They, maybe they started with us, but certainly didn't they make enough of a splash to make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you ever have any other interactions with the grievance process in terms of being involved as a counsel for anyone
no,
or on panels or any of that?
Never volunteered for any of that.
Okay.
I never did that.
Okay.
So.
Now, it's a part of what I'm doing this interview about is it's been in existence just over 40 years, and I need to get a little history written up about the number of cases and
yeah.
what's happened
Five,
during
so.
It and stuff. Of course, it's somewhat unique because this is a non-unionized faculty but with a grievance procedure that's maybe closer to what a union grievance procedure would look like than is often the case in other academic settings.
Except the scale of it most of the time is much smaller.
Uh-huh.
If we unionized, you'd have much more active kind of larger groups of people involved.
Uh-huh.
And I think the current grievance procedure is mostly a one-on-one thing about specific issues and not general issues like unionization.
So from your interactions in UCFA where the grievance official came and made reports, whether it was LaRue, Miller, Rubner, did you have any other feelings about how it was or wasn't working, the strengths or weaknesses of the procedure?
It was hard to tell because you only got some global figures.
Uh-huh.
And so you really couldn't piece things out.
Uh-huh.
So the ideal situation would have been if there had been decreases in grievances. I don't know whether they were or not.
Mm-hmm. I can show you another time some numbers.
Okay. Yeah, I think some grievance officers were more successful in settling grievances without it coming to a hearing.
Uh-huh.
And, but we didn't know about the details, so that's something we knew about.
I'll leave you something, and we can talk again another time, and this
okay.
also can get you to think about some of the kinds of issues that came up during those years.
Yeah.
And I would bet in a few weeks or a month you might think of some other things, and we'll get together again.
I'm sure I can. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else of major topics we should discuss in another...
I can't think of anything.
What year did you retire?
4 years, 2008.
Okay.
But I hadn't been on governance for about 3 or 4 or 5 years before then. So.
Yeah, you hadn't. I don't remember you doing governance during my years as grievance official and doing the FGO.
What happened was Pochin.
Mm-hmm.
Pochin suddenly got interested in being on committees and so on. And Pochin had the habit that when we had meetings, he would have us over to his building.
Right. I'm well familiar with those.
And
I also interviewed Jim.
Did you?
About the grievance procedure and about
yes.
academic governance.
Yes.
And
Jim, I remember having there was some meeting, there was a question about who was going to get elected to what. And we had a meeting right there in his building, in mm-hmm. the auditorium. And he stacked it with people he knew. And he had a student who knew from nothing nominate him. And I decided, I can't fight that. And so that's how I got out of governance. Until then, and he took whatever position I had. I forgot what it was.
Yeah, they changed the name in the titles of a couple of these, kind of the end story of the Faculty Voice thing was changing names of some of the big committees and stuff. But right before that occurred, Jim, for 2 years, was the person in charge of that. And I think there were some faculty, I would tell Jim this myself, who thought it wasn't right that he really was too much of an administrator, having run the department and still was so connected to it, for him to be serving as kind of the lead faculty representative on a body.
Yes. Well, but I think I had some criticism of myself by somebody that said, well, you're administrative because director of the cycling. They obviously didn't know what cycling was doing one thing. And so you shouldn't be able to run, but that was quickly over.
Right.
And so on.
But it's always a tension, I think, at the university because there are a few administrators who I think see themselves as they're an administrator and that's their
right.
career. But there's a very large percent of administrators who see themselves as a faculty member
exactly.
who's doing a stint of service
yes.
as an administrator, and they want to continue to be seen as a faculty member. But there's always a tension there during the time when they're
yes.
being the administrator. But I think for Jim, I think a number of faculty thought, you're really an administrator, and you're too connected to Luana and other
well,
parts of the...
Well, and Luana sort of did not object very much because... He had lots of influence.
Oh, he has tremendous influence.
Influence, and she wasn't going to buck him. She's,
yeah.
Whenever somebody had a lot of influence, she went along with it.
Yeah. So that's a criticism, but I'm also a fan of Jim in a lot of ways, too.
I am, too. In fact,
he gave his career to the place.
That's right.
He did
in
a
fact,
lot of good stuff.
He wrote a good letter for me when I was the one of two candidates for acting provost. Of course, I came in second.
Which year was that? For which job?
For the provost.
For acting
provost of the university.
At which time period?
This was just 10, 12 years ago when the guy from the dean from international studies was acting provost about 6 months while they were looking for a new provost. And I was
after Luana becomes president? Or are you talking about before Luana becomes provost?
No, after. It was the interim. It's before Wilcox.
Oh, well...
They had an acting provost.
Yeah, John Hudsick.
That's right. I was a nominee for the job.
I didn't realize that.
Along with John, and John beat me. John was selected because he was dean anyway. And he always did...
Well, he's the International Studies
yes.
dean.
Yes. So I was... But I
didn't realize you were a candidate.
I was pleased to have been a candidate. That was the Peter principle. That's as high as I ever got the administration.
I didn't realize that you were a candidate
Yeah, most
for
people
that.
Don't know.
Okay.
But I remembered it well.
Well, sure you would, if it was something you were willing to do.
Yes.
And at that point, were you doing governance, or you'd been out of it for a little while?
I think I was still doing governance, I think. I'm not sure. When was that?
Because that is the beginning of my... When I start FGO...
Yeah.
And my being interviewed was by Luann and Peter, but then about 6 months later, Peter leaves, and so Luana becomes the...
Yeah.
President,
well,
and Hudsick becomes the acting.
Yeah, I know I was active. I was in governance because when Peter was president, because he took me out to dinner one day to shape me up. And he had meatloaf, as I remember.
he was a character.
You thought he was a character. And then they had me, and then they called me up to have me on the as chair of the committee on the med school, which we can talk about another time.
Okay. Sounds great. Thank you.
Terrific.